Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Bruce Fein, who was a Deputy Attorney General in the Reagan administration and wrote the articles of impeachment for President Nixon and President Clinton. He was a senior policy advisor to the Ron Paul 2012 campaign, and we will discuss the bitter power struggles over the seating of Ron Paul's delegates and how Ron Paul has been shunned by the Republican National Committee and will not appear on stage at the convention in Tampa. Then we'll examine whether the White House can be bought and compare the record amount of spending so far, where monthly totals exceed the entire spending totals of previous races. Sheila Krumholz, who is the executive director of the Center for Responsive Politics, a nonpartisan organization that tracks money, politics, and influence in Washington, joins us. She has an article at CNN, "Will Money Buy the White House?" Then, following Mitt Romney's Bertha quip that got an enthusiastic response from a Republican audience, we will look into the big lies that are the basis of the Romney and Republican attacks on Obama, almost all of which have been completely manufactured, but are rarely challenged by the press. Mark Feldstein, an award-winning investigative correspondent for CNN, ABC, NBC, and a two-time winner of the George Foster Peabody Award, joins us to discuss a campaign that does not debate the facts, but rather invents them. And joining us now is Bruce Fein, who's a constitutional lawyer who formerly served as Associate Deputy Attorney General under the Reagan administration, General Counsel of the Federal Communications Commission, Research Director for the Joint Congressional Committee on Covert Arms Sales to Iran, and a member of the American Bar Association's Task Force on Presidential Signing Statements. He has authored several volumes on the United States Supreme Court, the United States Constitution, and international law, and helped write the articles of impeachment for President Nixon and President Clinton. Bruce Fein is the author of Constitutional Peril, The Life and Death Struggle for Our Constitution and Democracy, and his latest book is American Empire Before the Fall. He has been a senior policy advisor to the Ron Paul 2012 campaign. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bruce Fein.
Well, thank you, Ian. Delighted to be with you.
And apparently Ron Paul was offered a speaking spot at the convention, but with strings attached, that he would have to submit his speech for approval and vetting by the Romney team, and he would also have to fully endorse Mitt Romney for president. And I take it that, according to the New York Times, Ron Paul said it wouldn't be my speech, and that would undo everything I have done for the last 30 years. I don't fully endorse him for president. So, Is Ron Paul feeling shunned, rejected? Is he bitter? His delegates are, because they've been basically not seated after some very bitter internal struggles.
Well, Ron Paul is not the kind of person who becomes embittered. I think that what's happened this time is not all that different than in 2008, when he wasn't permitted to attend the convention floor, and he had a rival Campaign for Liberty event at the Target Center in Minneapolis. So he is someone who will continue forward with his ideas, and that being most important, he wasn't going to compromise so he could get some free airtime, you know, in prime time, and let what I would call neocon element of the Republican Party rewrite the speeches and try to enlist his endorsement of global military projection, coercion, predator drones, force as an answer to all the ills that the United States confronts. And it was more important that he keep on message in the long run in affecting the trajectory of our politics than it was to have a momentary 20 seconds of fame at the Republican National Committee convention.
Well, apparently they are going to have a video tribute to him at the convention, but that's sort of what they do for dead movie stars at the Academy Awards.
Yeah, exactly. So, and remember, you can control everything that's on a video, as you indicated, Ian. You can cut and censor and clip. So it's more tokenism than anything else. It's an effort to try to avoid having the Ron Paul contingent flee from both Obama and Romney and not cast a vote for the Republicans anyway in November.
So what's going to happen to those delegates down there who won their seats but haven't been seated by the state party conventions? And apparently there's quite a lot of bitterness, if not with Ron Paul himself, certainly with his delegates. And there's also, I think, the likelihood, is there not, that a lot of them will vote Libertarian rather than Republican?
Well, they will. Typically, Ian, you know, there's a rules committee that can decide delegate challenges of one sort or another, and the fact is that many of the delegates are not pledged in the primaries within their states, and many of them are devotees of Ron Paul and their efforts to try to clip them or suggest that they're acting in a way that's treasonous, since Mitt Romney received a majority of votes in some of these primary states. It's an effort basically to squelch the Ron Paul libertarian viewpoint from the convention, so it looks like you've got a unified party, even if it's unified, and in my view, of racing off an electoral cliff. But it's a pettiness element, and it really, I don't think, Ian, addresses the larger issue that's at stake here in the national convention, which is about the fundamental vision of what the United States is about and where we go forward, that's going to dwarf these little petty things. We know Romney's going to get the nomination, and that's what the focus ought to be on, what he's stating and what it suggests about the direction of the Republican Party.
Again, I'm speaking with Bruce Fine, who's a constitutional lawyer and formerly served as Associate Deputy Attorney General in the Reagan administration. He helped write the articles of impeachment for President Nixon and President Clinton, and is the author of American Empire Before the Fall, and he has been a senior policy advisor to the Ron Paul 2012 campaign. So let's talk about the speech that Ron Paul would give and what he attempted to do on the debates throughout the Republican primaries. He was sort of shunned by, I think, all of the candidates. Romney engaged in sometimes vigorous exchanges with Newt Gingrich and Rick Santorum, but never ever wanted to engage Ron Paul. What do you think? Was there a policy to try and ignore him?
Well, certainly, well, there's a policy trying to ignore him, marginalize him, present, you know, he didn't exist, and so they would talk about the third place finisher and Ron Paul was invisible at second place. But putting that aside, the main reason that Romney did not want to confront Ron Paul was twofold. Ron Paul really does believe that the United States should not go abroad in search of monsters to destroy, that we do not have a limitless presidency that can initiate war at whim, that it's assassination when you target people for victimization by predator drones without any due process at all, kill 16-year-olds, vaporize them without any proof that they've been engaged in any wrongdoing or threatened the United States. And he does not believe that the United States has an inherent endowment from God to play leadership, whatever that is, and march all over the world telling other countries what they ought to do, or else we'll drop bombs on them or shoot missiles at them or impose embargoes on them or otherwise. That's something that's totally contrary to what Mitt Romney has campaigned on. And it's not just the military projection of force and the arrogance that creates resentments abroad that threaten us, but it's a staggering cost. $1.2 trillion, a third of the federal budget, is a national security component. A third of the federal budget, more than all the rest of the world combined in their defense expenditures. And the Republican candidates, other than Ron Paul, did not want to confront that. They're still living in this fantasy land that we are an empire and that we somehow are endowed with exceptionalism and DNA, so we all have saintly elements in our disposition. We never do anything wrong, and therefore everybody should be thankful that we're occupying their country. The second thing that Ron Paul insisted upon is, hey, you actually have to really cut the budget if you're going to end a $16 trillion debt. And he put out a plan for a $1 trillion budget deficit, a huge cut to $500 billion in the Defense Department. And other, he didn't have to stumble like Mr. Perry about some departments he'd eliminate, the Department of Education or Department of Commerce. And this is something that Romney, again, simply scampered away from. He's he yells, well, we need to have more frugal government, but he studiously avoids identifying where the cuts are going to come from. It's just some mysterious disappearing of numbers. And Ron Paul was clear, and he was unambiguous, and that's the opposite of Mr. Romney, who wants to be elusive, a chameleon, you know, everything to everybody at every time. And that's what I think Ron Paul opposed and prevented him from endorsing Mr. Romney.
Well, of course, not only does Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan not agree with Ron Paul on defense spending, they actually want to increase defense spending. I mean, both of them have called for more defense spending. And
yeah, it's really quite staggering. More defense spending when we're already spending more than the rest of the world combined. You know, we're developing weapons that would never be used in a million years. It's like we're planning for the possible invasion from, you know, against the Land Rover in Mars or something. These weapon systems, you know, what would they be used for? Especially ridiculous because the military experts say, well, the future of conflict is with these guerrillas. It's special forces. It's not these huge armies and navies and squadrons of aircraft flying over and bombing. So what are we building these? Anyway, some of these planes, Ian, they cost $200, $300, $500 million per copy, you know?
Well, the one that...
Where are we going to use them, you know, in Afghanistan? Oh, we can bomb the stones there.
Right, the one, by the way, that costs $500 million a copy, that's the F-22 Raptor. It's grounded because the pilots are passing out from asphyxiation because they can't even get the oxygen system right. So it's not just that we spend $500 million on useless weapons. They're not even usable in the most fundamental sense that they can actually fly.
That is correct. And moreover, this huge component of our economy, what Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex, it is the least competitive. It is where you have single-source contracts, where you talk about, you know, comfort. It's a, kind of like a TARP program for the military-industrial complex as it was for the banks. So there's no competition there. This is welfare for big corporations, which is why these defense contractor CEOs get paid more than even the bank CEOs that are $1 trillion in assets. And this refusal to look at the military and cut it to a sensible level is what hugely distinguishes Ron Paul and his campaign from Mitt Romney and to some degree Mr. Obama as well, who's given no inclination to slash defense expenditures and is already planning another 10 years in Afghanistan after 2014.
So, Bruce Fein, again, senior policy advisor to the Ron Paul 2012 campaign. The party itself, though, not only is Ron Paul's a part of the big GOP tent being shunned, it does feel like traditional Republicans, you know, it used to be it's not your daddy's Republican Party anymore, certainly not your granddaddy's Republican Party, which used to be dominated by the Northeast. The Northeast is now, I don't think, has just about anybody elected in the Northeast on the Republican ticket, with a few exceptions. But it's largely, and of course the Democrats used to control the South through the Dixiecrats. Now that's become entirely red and Republican. But most observers see the new Republican Party as being more concerned about private personal issues and religious issues than they are about policy issues. And how does that sit with you and Ron Paul?
I think the view of Mr. Paul and the libertarian group, and I would put myself into that category, is that the government has no business telling you what to do or invading your right to be left alone unless there's a clear and compelling interest. And ordinarily, even if that interest is important, it's a decision for states to make, not for the federal government to decide whether there ought to be same-sex marriage. You know, it's not for the federal government to have positions on abortion, if you will. These are things for the states. My view is that you have the right to be left alone unless what you're doing is clearly threatening the social order. And the separation of church and state is an important element of the right to be left alone, because religion really doesn't have any compromised positions in it. It's a private matter between you and whatever you believe the supreme being, and the government should stay out in every way, fashion, or form. And that doesn't mean, however, that religion gives you an exemption from complying with laws that everyone else has to comply with. It need even-handed application of the law, but the Republicans have turned the campaign or politics into sort of a relic of Puritan blue laws that were existent 200 years ago, which I think will cause certainly younger voters to flee elsewhere, including to a libertarian camp or a revised or revamped Republican Party that understands what the party initially believed when it was born in 1850s, 150 years ago.
So what then keeps Ron Paul in the Republican Party? I mean, his son Rand Paul is a U.S. senator, a Republican U.S. senator, and he's going to be allowed to speak at the convention, whereas Ron Paul, who, you know, came in second in many states, and third in pretty much all of them, would normally, under normal circumstances, somebody that had earned that many delegates and that many votes would be given a fairly prominent role, and he's been effectively shunned. I'm just wondering what keeps you in the Republican Party if they have inherited the even more strident neocon element than George W. Bush had, which brought us the Iraq and Afghanistan misadventures, and the candidate's already being much, much more belligerent, wanting to us to intervene in against Iran and against Syria, et cetera. And then you add to that all of this obsession with the so-called social issues and the personal issues about women's bodies and all of that stuff of personhood that's in the Republican platform. I'm just struggling here, Bruce, just in the last minute or so to try and figure out why you and Ron Paul are still in the party, or do you think you can take the party back?
Well, that's, it's more of a tactical issue than a philosophical one. You don't have, if you flee the party, in some sense, it becomes more extreme. And belonging to the party doesn't mean that you have to echo the party line. You can say you think that the party really has lost the true colors of the Republican Party. It may well be at some time it's more advantageous, since really what I view politics about is what's good for America, not what's good for Republicans or Democrats. We want everybody to win. It's a matter of finding the appropriate vehicle and an organization where you can accomplish that. But you need to recognize, too, that if everybody flees the party, it clearly will become more rather than less extreme. But at some point, maybe that's the only way you've got to move forward. The Republican Party was a successor to the Whig Party and the Liberty Party at one time when it was born, and maybe there's time for bringing forth a new party that's more than just marginal or fringe in order to have the United States regain a sense of what it is and should be as a nation. And not an empire.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Bruce Fine.
Thank you, Ian.
Okay. Again, I've been speaking with Bruce Fine, who's a constitutional lawyer who formerly served as Associate Deputy Attorney General in the Reagan administration. He was General Counsel of the Federal Communications Commission, Research Director for the Joint Congressional Committee on Covert Arms Sales to Iran, and a member of the American Bar Association's Task Force on Presidential Signing Statements. He has authored several volumes on the United States Supreme Court, the United States Constitution, and international law, and helped write the articles of impeachment for President Nixon and President Clinton. Bruce Fine is the author of Constitutional Peril, The Life and Death Struggle for Our Constitution and Democracy, and his latest book is American Empire Before the Fall. He has been a senior policy advisor to the Ron Paul 2012 campaign. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about whether or not the White House can be bought.
And maybe I just don't see the reason, but in the core of my heart, you're
and buy me love, love, and buy me love. I'll buy you a diamond ring, my friend, if it makes you feel all right. I'll get you anything, my friend, if it makes you feel all right. 'Cause I don't care too much for money, but money can buy me love. I'll give you all I've got to give if you say you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Sheila Krumholz, who is the Executive Director of the Center for Responsive Politics, a nonpartisan organization that tracks money, politics, and influence in Washington. She first joined the Center for Responsive Politics in 1989, serving as assistant editor of the very first edition of Open Secrets, the center's flagship publication. She has an article at CNN, Will Money Buy the White House? Welcome to Background Briefing, Sheila Krumholz.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And the convention that's just getting underway in Tampa, Florida, of course, it will be delayed a day because of the weather. But I think most people see it as a sort of patriotic display of our kind of Tweedledum parties, each sort of out doing each other in terms of how many flags they can fly and making the most their patriotic appeals to the American people, etc. But what goes on behind the scenes at the various lunches, dinners, events, caucuses, etc., I think escapes a lot of people's attention. And it's worth noting that almost all of those activities that are going on surrounding this convention are paid for by lobbyists and trade groups, all doing business with the Congress and with a potential Romney-Ryan White House. Do you find that that is the hidden story of conventions, or particularly of late?
Absolutely. That is the unwritten rule, that behind the scenes, in front of our TVs, we see a lot of flags and balloons and bunting and people, you know, smiling and clapping and wearing funny hats. But behind the scenes are the parties that they're not invited to or privy to, that the press are not allowed to attend, where a lot of fundraising is happening, a lot of kind of deal making and trading of favors, looking for support, both financial and other, among policymakers, party operatives, and those that they rely upon to feed the beast, the lobbyists, the corporate and labor executives, and those who have the resources both to make contributions and to get out the vote.
So in terms of your article at CNN, Sheila Krumholz, Will Money Buy the White House? You've got some historical data in here that would indicate to me that even going back to recent races, Bill Clinton and Dole, et cetera, that the monthly total that particularly Romney is raising exceeds the entire total of recent presidential races.
Well, part of that is, they say a significant part of that is that the public financing system has disappeared, and that had provided a level playing field for the final weeks of the election for both parties, candidates, nominees, for a couple of decades. So here we are in the midst of our second presidential race in which at least one of the nominees, now both of the nominees, are rejecting public funding for the general, and that means that the race is on, the sky's the limit. They need to suck in as many dollars as they possibly can over the next few weeks, both to the candidates' campaigns as well as to the party committees, and now to outside groups, these super PACs and their nonprofit counterparts. So there's money coming from all sources and going to all these major pockets and coffers and for the candidates now. I doubt either of them are going to surpass by much anyway Obama's extraordinary take in 2008, but we're talking hundreds of millions of dollars.
And the reason that public financing doesn't work anymore is that it was basically rejected by George W. Bush, and then in 2008 by Barack Obama, and that's it's essentially sort of withered on the vine. Is that what happened? Or it became irrelevant, I guess.
Precisely. But it had peaked in the early 80s. That was the point at which the most Americans, I believe it was about 30% of Americans, had signed, checked that, at that time, $1 checkoff, and finally at the end, a $3 checkoff on their taxes to have $1 or $3 go toward the public financing system for our presidential elections. But I think that really had never been appropriately or sufficiently marketed to the American populace, to the voters. And so that there were, it was both, there were insufficient funds coming in, and there, it was not growing sufficient to provide an attractive option if those for those candidates who thought that they could raise far more money on their own, such as Barack Obama in 2008, there was really no question, no option. So in this case, in this cycle, there was really no question that either candidate was going to use the public financing system, and that is, I think, a real shame because it did again level the playing field, provide serious funding, good funding, but allow those candidates to know that they had enough resources to then focus on the campaign instead of the money race.
And again, I'm speaking with Sheila Krumholz, Executive Director of the Center for Responsive Politics, a nonpartisan organization that tracks money, politics, and influence in Washington. And she has an article at CNN, Will Money Buy the White House? Now, we are at a very peculiar time in terms of American democracy, where up to 5 million Americans who have voted previously and are registered and eligible to vote who want to vote Democrat are being denied the vote and have to jump through hoops in order to get the vote, whereas a handful of billionaires who are essentially buying the election for the Republicans don't have to identify who they are. So that's an extraordinary disconnect there. And then you've got at this convention starting in Florida, a big salute to entrepreneurs, Building America, honoring David Koch through Americans for Prosperity. That's one of the events that are going to be going on. One of the things that's so extraordinary about not just the floodgates have been opened by the Supreme Court Citizens United decision, but the other decision, which is a different court, which is the 501c4 tax-exempt foundation that's being used supposedly for some social virtue, is being used now as a black box, if you will, for money. And there's a fear amongst a lot of people that the corporate America is using this device where they can hide behind anonymity, because corporations, of course, when they give money to a Democrat or Republican, particularly if they're involved in a consumer product, they're likely to alienate half of their customers, since the parties basically divide the country 50-50. So this seems to me to be a device, and it was largely, it wasn't so much created by Karl Rove, but certainly exploited by Karl Rove, that may well be tipped the balance here. We don't know. We talked about how big corporations and lobbying groups are down there in Tampa now popping the champagne and offering yacht rides and cigars and whatever, but we don't know what kind of money they're pouring in, do we?
We have no idea what these 501c political nonprofits are raising, who it's being raised from, and ultimately how much they are spending to shape this upcoming vote. Unfortunately, it is, I think, true that they are using and abusing the tax exempt status of nonprofits, they have found this way to, as kind of wolf in sheep's clothing, to skirt the disclosure limits and have their cake and eat it, to raise unlimited sums from any source. And frankly, they say it's not coming from foreign sources, but it very well could be. We all have no way of knowing. And to be able to run messages that are purportedly coming from some trustworthy group because they're using these patriotic anodyne names, but in fact we don't know who's behind the messages we're being bombarded with as viewers, as voters. And because of that, I think all of us, Republicans, Democrats, Independents, we have no way of truly being able to consider the source. And it is true that most of the money is being spent by conservative groups, but you can be rest assured that everybody's the gloves are off, and everybody across the ideological spectrum is trying to use this this subterfuge now available to them to sell voters possibly a bill of goods. At a minimum, they're not being completely forthright about their messaging because, you know, they know that this is it's very effective for them to, again, use these loopholes to get around the disclosure limits and to just try to keep it as kind of patriotic and vague sounding as possible while delivering very negative, often very deceptive messages. So I think we as voters, as citizens, can't do our job effectively because we just don't know enough about these groups and the money behind them. And the money may be coming from a really, you know, wonderfully representative, you know, massive number of donors, individuals, you know, upstanding Americans, or it may be coming, as they say, from one single donor, from an individual, from a corporation, from a union, and frankly, again, from foreign entities, corporations, or even governments. We know that there has been, they have the wherewithal in foreign lands to provide the money, big money, and we also know they have the willingness, because we went through the scandals of the 90s, where it was learned that big money was flowing to the parties from foreign entities and even governments on both sides, both Democrats and Republicans. So, you know, I think it is a serious concern, and I think it's unlikely that at this point the tide is going to turn before this election. I just hope that we learn enough about what happened after the fact to consider how this system might be made healthier.
Well, we know that the first thing that Paul Ryan did when he became the vice presidential nominee on the Romney ticket was to go and kneel before Sheldon Adelson. And Sheldon Adelson himself has made it very clear that he actually said that, "I wish that I had never served in the United States military and I had in fact served in the Israeli military." And he's awfully close to Israel. I'm not suggesting that it's foreign money, but it's certainly money with a lot of foreign influence in his case. And he's the biggest donor so far, at least we know about it, right? In his case, we don't. But at this convention, the American Petroleum Institute putting on dinners and concerts and panels promoting the Keystone Pipeline, that's business before, obviously, a lot of people are going to benefit, including the Koch brothers. So you see the direct connection on the Republican side. On the Democratic side, I'm sure the same corporate bottom feeders are going to show up like sharks in Charlotte. But in terms of the money raising, there's no question that Romney's outstripping Obama every month now. And there's a very disturbing article in The New Yorker by Jane Mayer called Schmooze or Lose. Obama doesn't like cozying up to billionaires. Could it cost him the election? And that posits the question and by interviewing lots and lots of billionaires and big donors to Obama, all of whom feel slighted because he hasn't been stroking them in what is called in the trade, Sheila, donor maintenance. Apparently, Bill Clinton was an expert at donor maintenance, and Obama just finds the whole thing extremely unpleasant. So could that be a deciding factor, the fact that you got a candidate who's president of the United States and who actually wants to do his job as president of the United States and finds all of this groveling for money demeaning? And as a result, he's simply going to be outspent, because at any moment, Sheldon Adelson can decide to write a $1 billion check if he wants to.
It's true. I think there are a number of ways to look at this. The candidates themselves have already raised hundreds of millions. Mitt Romney, nearly $200 million. Barack Obama, nearly $350 million for the campaigns themselves. And they have the parties raising yet more for their campaigns, on behalf of their nominees. And a single individual can give, at a pop, $75,000 to the victory funds, to the joint fundraising committees that are raising money for the party and the campaign. So big money coming from well-heeled donors going to the campaigns and the parties. I feel that despite the fact that there's all of this outside money, which can come from any source in any denomination at any time, I do think that the campaigns do have sufficient resources to get their messages out, and that at the end of the day, it's most likely that this campaign, I'm hopeful that this campaign will not be won or lost based on the money. But it is true in congressional elections, as in presidential elections, that the vast majority of winners are the candidates that spent the most. In fact, in 2010, last cycle, in the House, only 9 winning challengers spent under $1 million. So the fact is, you have to reach a certain threshold of financial viability to even be in the game, to even be considered a contender at all. But then, for the presidential campaign and for congressional campaigns this time, it's just much more changeable at any moment, because someone could swoop in, drop big money, $1 million or $10 million or $50 million, in a very targeted way that could change the course of the election, potentially, even in the presidential, but especially in those House races where it could tip the favor toward one party or another. So I do think that we are imperiled if we are not paying attention to who these people are and how this could be kind of pawns in the game of the money race.
Well, as you've pointed out in your article at CNN, Will Money Buy the White House, Sheila Krumholz, in 2004, Senate candidates who raised the most money won 88% of the time, and House candidates who raised the most money won an astonishing 97.8% of the time. And then in terms of presidential elections, the record's pretty clear. The people that have the most money win, with the exception of Bill Clinton in 1996, who didn't raise as much as Senator Dole, and Ronald Reagan, who raised less than Jimmy Carter in 1980, but nevertheless won in a landslide. So no question that money talks, right?
It does, but it is not all. We have to be, I think, optimistic that we can make a difference if we turn out in droves, if we are paying attention, if we are prepared eventually to get the system of campaign financing right in our country. So I think we need to be very observant in this election about who the forces are at work, how much they're spending, where they're spending it, and how. And if we can, the sources of that funding, and the Center for Responsive Politics, and on our website, opensecrets.org, we're trying to scratch at the edges of those nonprofits, those non-disclosing groups that are hiding their donors. And we're finding bits and pieces and kind of tying together the network of who these people are and what their legislative agenda is, and trying to apprise people of kind of what's at stake. But you know, at the end of the day, the good news is that money isn't all it takes. You also have to have a threshold of viability in terms of skills, experience, knowledge, a good campaign system. I mean, you have to have kind of all of the pieces. These candidates must have all of the pieces of the puzzle in place, including, you know, hustle and name recognition, of course, for congressional campaigns, but also, you know, they have to be charismatic and likable and skilled. So money is a critical factor. It's not all it takes. You need more than that. But for those campaigns that are kind of have reached that vaunted status of big money, big ticket campaigns, it may, you know, the money is being leveraged in a very strategic way to get the most bang for their buck. And again, we might see a very changeable last few weeks of the election as that money is put into motion.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us today, Sheila Krumholz.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Sheila Krumholz, who's the Executive Director of the Center for Responsive Politics, a nonpartisan organization that tracks money, politics, and influence in Washington. She first joined the Center for Responsive Politics in 1989, serving as assistant editor of the very first edition of Open Secrets, the Center's flagship publication. She has an article at CNN, Will Money Buy the White House? We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the big lies that are the basis of the Romney Republican campaign.
It's the money, money, money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mark Feldstein, who's a professor of journalism at the University of Maryland and author of Poisoning the Press, Richard Nixon, Jack Anderson, and the Rise of Washington Scandal Culture. For over two decades, he has been an award-winning investigative correspondent for CNN, ABC, NBC, and is a two-time winner of the George Foster Peabody Award. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Feldstein.
Great to be here, Ian.
And just a couple of days ago, Mitt Romney campaigning in his hometown in Michigan made a quip about a birth quip, if you will, where he said, nobody's ever asked for my birth certificate, which got an enormous and enthusiastic response from the crowd. And I think it's pretty clear from polling that the majority of Republican voters believe that President Obama is an imposter. He is a Muslim interloper without a birth certificate. And, you know, because of the so-called Kenyan connection, it's difficult to not see this as racism, thinly disguised or barely disguised. And the whole thing is really quite monstrous. But here you have a presidential candidate instead of, as the previous candidate for the Republican presidency, John McCain, who rebuked a woman who called Obama an Arab and a Muslim. This guy has been given ample opportunities to distance himself from that kind of disgusting rhetoric, but instead he's embraced it.
Well, you know, I think that unfortunately that's true, Ian. You know, he was the one so-called moderate in the race, running a bunch against a bunch of largely, you know, kind of very hard right, you know, lunatic fringe. And, no matter what he does, he has been unable to really appease that hardcore base. And so but he's still trying. You know, he's trying with the appointment of Paul Ryan and with his not-so-funny joke about Obama, which really, you know, watching the delivery didn't look much like a joke. It looked pretty like a pretty calculated attempt to throw some red meat to the lunatic birther movement. And, you know, when you combine that with the voter suppression attempts that are going on around various key states, it does feel like the strategy, perhaps on both sides, but certainly on the Republican side, seems to be to, you know, appeal to the base and to suppress the turnout of the opposition.
So I guess it comes down to how many angry white men there are in this country and how many there are who, you know, could appeal to their better angels.
Well, yeah, and the polls seem to suggest that, you know, the actual number of undecideds, independents that are really swing voters is small, and so then the premium becomes on getting out your base, and that's what I think we're starting to see more of. You know, there's always a danger you appeal too much to the base and you start to you know, lose folks in the middle. Usually that's where the elections are won, but things have become so polarized that there's more of an appeal to the extremes.
Which is what the president just said in an interview with the Associated Press, that he's used the word extreme, that Mitt Romney has embraced extreme positions. When you say that it's now pretty clear that they're not angling for the center, which normally at this point both sides would be appealing to the center, but instead Mitt Romney keeps pandering to his base by picking Paul Ryan and by his Bertha quip, etc. Conversely, I don't see Obama firing up his base. At least a lot of the young people that voted in 2008, I'm not sure, you know, with the registration deadlines, etc., unless an effort's made, I think they could lose.
Oh, well, you know, I definitely think they could lose. And, you know, you started to see in August some hitting back on Romney and negative attack ads by the Obama campaign and those associated or supporting him that have tried to define Romney in negative terms. You know, so much so that the Republicans were calling it Swift voting, which is kind of ironic. I think the pick of Ryan is really, you know, interesting because, you know, you look at it, and this is the guy who wants to gut Medicare as we know it, and as we've always known it, and instead of sort of admitting that openly, he's, you know, being packaged as the man who's trying to save Medicare, you know, appearing with his mother in Florida, you know, in a way that really seems designed. You talk about the big lie and the song you were playing at the beginning. I mean, it's just a kind of a monstrous distortion of reality to suggest that Ryan and the voucher plan, which would, you know, really replace Medicare and that as we know it, is saving it. And that's really quite shameless. But that's, you know, as a matter of packaging, Ryan looks like a young, earnest, you know, Midwesterner standing there with his mom, you know, never mind the fact that, you know, they don't really need Medicare. They have the income and the assets that most Americans don't. It will be interesting to see whether Ryan is more palatable at some level than the, you know, multimillionaire Romney with his obvious faux pas about wealth and his offshore overseas investments and so forth.
Again, I'm speaking with Mark Feldstein, a professor of journalism at the University of Maryland and for two decades an award-winning investigative correspondent for CNN, ABC, NBC, and a two-time winner of the George Foster Peabody Award. But this is the problem, the way I see it, in terms of an adult debate, in terms of an honest political debate. It used to be that candidates debated the issues and the issues were understood. In this case, they're not debating the facts. They're lying about the facts and they're inventing the facts. And this has been going on since Obama became president. People on the right in this country have invented a completely separate narrative about who this man is, that he's a Muslim, imposter, terrorist-loving, anti-colonial, subversive, etc. And it's resonating. And we know from the polling that up to, you know, at least a third, perhaps of the entire country, but it's certainly up to half of the Republican voters believe this stuff. And Romney just threw them a bone the other day. Dinesh D'Souza, this fellow who wrote this incredibly ridiculous book about Obama's Kenyan roots and his Mau Mau influence, etc. He's made a film that's out now that's apparently doing pretty well at the box office. I haven't seen it, but I imagine it's an extension of the lies in his books. Again, if you read Obama's books about his father, it was pretty clear that the opposite was true. His father was essentially driven to his grave by the ruling party. Not hardly. If anything, he would be, influenced by the opposite of Mau Mauism. But the facts don't matter. I mean, that is, I think, is a problem we have in the culture in general, that people do reality shopping. Liberals watch MSNBC, conservatives watch Fox, Christians watch Christian television and radio, listen to Christian radio, and so we don't have a consensus. But I don't understand why the press aren't at least, since they're the last hope we have here, demanding an honest debate about the facts, not about these manufactured facts.
Well, one thing I think, I agree, and one thing I think you can't underestimate is how much the media landscape has changed over the past generation. It used to be, for better or for worse, Americans got their news from television, three networks, and that was it. And they were all pretty middle-of-the-road mainstream networks, and they placed objectivity, however you define that, as their kind of along with truth, as their paramount goal. And, there were a lot of problems with that and limits in the kind of gray coverage that was provided. But there were some, attempts at truth-telling, and you'd had someone like Walter Cronkite, the CBS news anchor, after the Tet Offensive, go on the air and basically say it's a stalemate and not winnable. And that would try to get beyond just the propaganda of that the sides put out and tried to get to the truth. And, he had an audience of tens of millions of people, and the story is told, maybe apocryphal, that Lyndon Johnson, the president, said, "If I've lost Walter Cronkite, I've lost the country." Well, there is nobody sort of comparable in today's media landscape, and to blow the whistle that way and to referee it in a way that really has an impact, and instead you have this fractured media landscape where, as you say, people tune into the views that they already have and have their prejudices confirmed and validated. And so truth doesn't catch up, and you have an entire sort of right-wing propaganda machine, Fox News being, the most potent of them, that reinforce these big lies about Obama and the birthers and so forth. And, 40% of all Republicans, a poll I just read in the last 24 hours, get their news from Fox News. Truth doesn't catch up. It's truthiness, as Stephen Colbert, the comedian, likes to joke. It's what feels true, what people want to believe, not what empirical reality is.
So is there anything that can be done, though, in terms of refereeing and having a reality check here in the last minute or two, Mark Feldstein? Because from day one, Romney's first ads that he put out in Iowa put John McCain's words in Obama's mouth, which is absolutely disgraceful. But he's continued to do this. I mean, his attacks ads about Obama's waivers for welfare are a complete lie. They're completely made up. They're designed to get the angry white voter thinking that Obama wants their hard-earned money to be handed over to a bunch of freeloaders. Then you've got this lie coming out now, and their commercials about him wanting to take all this money out of Medicare, when in fact it's that boondoggle Medicare Advantage money that's being repackaged in so-called Obamacare. So again, you'd think that they'd be talking about the issues, and the one side wouldn't be able to simply make up their own narrative rather than address what's really happening to the country and what needs to be done. They just make up lies, and they distract everybody's attention to the lie, and you don't get even to discuss the truth.
Well, and the Democrats have, and Obama has to, they have to hit back, and they have to expose it. You know, it's much harder than before now with the Citizens United Supreme Court decision, because you have billionaires who can give, you know, unlimited amounts of cash to these super PACs to they can say anything. But the president is still the president of the United States. He still has a big megaphone, and the Democrats have to do what they're not necessarily as good at as the Republicans, and that's hit back in attack form and expose these lies. I think we're going to see one grueling and nasty fall campaign. Mitt Romney's and his supporters have huge amounts of money, unprecedented amounts of money squirreled away, and it is going to be one nasty mudfest this fall.
And of course, all this money that they raise goes to the media, the mainstream media, and of course, they don't have an incentive to improve this broken system because they're the beneficiaries of it.
It's exactly quite the opposite. They have devoted very little attention to the ways in which they profit. Because it's
a windfall for them, right?
It is indeed.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Mark Feldstein.
My pleasure, as always.
Again, I've been speaking with Mark Feldstein. He's a professor of journalism at the University of Maryland and author of Poisoning the Press, Richard Nixon, Jack Anderson, and the Rise of Washington Scandal Culture. For over two decades, he has been an award-winning investigative correspondent for CNN, ABC, NBC, and he's a two-time winner of the George Foster Peabody Award. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producers Michelle Manos and Brooke Peterson. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.